Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, getting the most out of your relationship with your financial advisor. A new book from an advisor himself, John DeGooey. It's a fiery one. It's called Stand Up to the Financial Services Industry, Protecting Yourself from Well-Intended but Oblivious Advisors. Ouch. Then personal injury lawyer Megan Jakin is here to talk about what you need to know about your rights if you get hurt. And these days, cash only is a phrase you dread when you approach the cashier with your credit card in hand. But according to Payments Canada, cash use in Canada has declined by 30% in the last decade. So are we ready for a cashless future? Equitable Bank CEO Andrew Moore will be here to talk about the pros and cons of going cashless. And author and entrepreneur Jennifer Buchanan on her new book, Wellness Incorporated, The Health Entrepreneur's Handbook. Plus, Mike Geipert from Wealthsimple joins us to tell us about his new investing masterclass. Do we really need content from financial institutions? All that's ahead. Let's get started. Personal injury lawyers, you've probably seen their advertising. The billboards are up along many of our major highways. Some of it is packed with hyperbole. But unless you've been involved in a case yourself, you probably don't have much of an idea of what your rights are. I certainly don't. And I hope I never have to really know. But I have been curious about some of the basics. And I thought, you know what, let's talk about it preemptively. So you listen to this interview and karmically, you'll never need the information yourself. It's just perfect. Megan Hall-Jacquin is a personal injury lawyer and partner at Howie Sachs and Henry. She joins us now to discuss the disability rights you should be aware of and some options you have if you are injured off the job. Hello there.
Hi there.
So the incident that prompts our discussion was hearing about a friend who slipped outside of a bathroom in a restaurant. She hit her head. She had a concussion. She's been off work for 6 months. So I'd like to use that as sort of an example and as a way for you to start to describe what your rights are if you are injured off the job.
Sure. So poor her, first of all.
Poor her, yeah.
So it's really intimidating at first when you've suffered an injury and you got to figure out what you have to do next, what you have available to you. And a lot of people have, through their workplace, access to long-term disability benefits. And that requires an application. But more importantly, it requires the injured person to understand what benefits might be available to them. And that's very policy specific.
And tough to do when you've been injured. I mean, hopefully you've got a family member or a trusted colleague who can help you navigate that. There are also people for whom there is no backstop at work. What about for them?
So that's a really good point, actually. A lot of people submit applications not knowing what the disability test is and not having the medical support that they need to show the insurance company that they meet that disability test.
What is that test?
Again, it's policy specific. So the first 2 years is generally, can you not do your own job? After the first 2 years, so we're getting on into long-term disability, it's any occupation that you're not able to do. And that's why right from the get-go, you need to have the medical support from your doctor or your other treatment providers to support your application.
What are the circumstances in which calling a personal injury lawyer makes sense? And I'm going to ask you to be as objective as you can, given that this is what pays your mortgage. But when do you know as the injured person when it's worth the money for that consult or the time or the energy, regardless, and when you should begin proceedings on your own?
So I can't speak about other personal injury lawyers, but in terms of my work at Howie Sachs and Henry, the consultation is free. And I would encourage everybody, friends, family, people I don't know, to call a lawyer quite quickly. And the reason, again, is because the test for disability is so policy specific, if you don't have the medical support right from the beginning, you could be hurting yourself in the long term. Because as we all know, a lot of insurance companies deny a lot of legitimate claims. And if this scenario you talk about with the woman with the concussion, if she's also got physical issues, she may just submit an application that's only got half of the information that she requires. So speaking to a personal injury lawyer sooner than later to get an understanding of what you're facing, what your risks might be, how you can front end load your case if it gets to that is always a good idea.
What are the scenarios? Now, I'm leaping well into the future for this person with an injury or any person with an injury. What are the scenarios that could unfold? I assume there's, you know, out of court settlement, there's a court case, there's nothing. Give us a flavor of what the potential scenarios are.
So the person could either be approved and paid long-term disability benefits, or they could be denied. And if they're denied, they can face either an appeals process, which is internal, and it's usually 99% of the time unsuccessful, or they can sue. And when you sue, you go through the litigation and 96-97% of cases settle outside of trial, which means that we are able to get for them long-term disability benefits. So that's a weekly income replacement benefit for the past, present, and into the future till they're 65.
Now, I'm going to ask you an unfair question. I mentioned the ads off the top, and there is a certain, like, oh, I don't know, when you look at that ad. How do you feel when you see some of those ads and the level of cheese factor that is associated with some of them?
So that's a good question. My firm actually does not advertise. We receive referrals from lawyers, from treatment providers that respect us in the community. And at Howie Sachs and Henry, we really do focus on our clients and on our reputation in the industry. So we've kind of stayed out of that, and we're able to build our practice based on our reputation, based on our results in settlements, but also in trials.
Do you wish people didn't advertise like that? It doesn't seem to be great for you at a cocktail party to say, yeah, I'm a personal injury lawyer. And they say, oh, like, do you have a billboard?
Yeah. So I really do feel strongly that we should not be advertising the way we are. I know that it does put a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. And just, you know, going on our reputation and our track record, the fact that we are consistently voted among the top in Canada at Howie Sachs and Henry really gives us a lot to go on in terms of getting those clients.
What are the differences Canada versus the U.S.? And I ask because oftentimes we hear these crazy stories about someone suing McDonald's because the coffee was too hot and all these kinds of things. Certainly there's something different in our culture, but what's different in the legal framework between Canada and the U.S.?
So, for example, there is a cap on general damages, which is the amount that you can claim in any lawsuit for pain and suffering in Canada. And it was set way back many, many years ago, and it's increased with inflation, but it's still about $338,000 or $340,000. There's no such cap in most of the U.S. And again, things with long-term disability benefits are policy driven. So that's a contract that you have, and you can't escape the maximum that they would pay for income replacement on a weekly basis.
If we come back to that restaurant example, is the restaurant reliant on a policy to cover them for these sorts of things? Is that who then you would go and go after?
So the long-term disability benefits would be through a contract that your employer has that you may have.
So the person
access
who fell.
To.
Yep.
Yes, exactly. And the restaurant may be liable for not cleaning the floors, or there may be a third-party contractor that was supposed to clean the floors that didn't. So certainly an action would be brought against the restaurant itself for the injuries sustained. And that goes along with the long-term disability application and lawsuit if necessary.
You must spend a lot of time educating people in that first conversation on, you know, I'm going to say the top 2 to 3 things that they need to know. If you could snap your fingers and have Canadians just know the top 2 to 3 things to know about personal injury and about the cases that you receive or see, what would be those things that you would want everybody to know?
I would say first, talk to a lawyer, because they can help guide you in what the application looks like and what the future looks like. Second, make sure that you have all of the medical support that you need. And third, going through the internal appeals process at a long-term disability insurer is 99% of the time you're only spinning your wheels, frustrating yourself, getting exhausted. So you may as well contact a lawyer immediately when you get a denial of the benefit so that they can start a lawsuit for you.
And when you work with a lawyer, are you often paying out of pocket like you would for any other legal service? Or do most people who do what you do have contingency, have their fee be based on what award is received?
So again, I can't speak with others, but at Howie Sachs and Henry, we work on a contingency basis, which means that we get paid a percentage of the result at the end of the case.
How does that affect, do you think that affects how you work? It would seem to me that if that was how you were compensated, you'd be like very incented to go for the highest possible settlement.
It's true. I mean, if we do better, we get paid more. And if we don't do as well, we don't get paid as well. However, we also do have a long-term view on our practice. Our reputation is everything. This is how we get our work. This is why we get the results that we get. And so we also want to be fair and diplomatic, unless the insurer is being unreasonable, in which case we say, okay, we'll see you at trial.
Right. We just have 30 seconds left. Why do you do what you do? You could have chosen any field of law. Why this one?
Honestly, it's because I care about people. And when people are injured in an accident, they truly are victims. Their lives are turned upside down and they don't have the capacity or the ability to speak for themselves, to navigate a complicated insurance scheme, insurance industry, to fight. So I'm their voice and it's an honor to be their voice.
Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Megan Hall-Jacquin is a personal injury lawyer and partner at Howie, Sachs & Henry.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Great advisors are out there, and they deserve to be paid. But what exactly is great, and how much is worth it? Author and financial advisor John DeGuy is here to tell us about his new book, Stand Up to the Financial Services Industry, Protecting Yourself from Well-Intended but Oblivious Advisors. Hello there, John.
Hi, Bruce.
You are not going to win many friends with that subline there.
I'm not looking to gain new friends.
You're fully staffed on the friend front.
Yeah, I'm really hoping to save people from advisors that are sort of giving them advice that's misguided and they don't even realize it.
When you say
the investors know the advisors,
right? When you say oblivious, what do you mean?
A paper came out in 2016 showing that advisors, beyond any reasonable doubt, are misguided. So they are misguided because they make recommendations based on past performance, even though everything says past performance can't be relied upon, might not be repeated. They run concentrated portfolios. They use high-cost products, even though there's mountains of evidence that cost is an important determinant of performance. So the advisors, while well-intended, while they're trying to help their clients reach their financial goals, are in fact doing so, which, in spite of their good intentions, while being completely unaware of or certainly not paying any attention to the evidence that what they're doing is in fact incorrect.
The cynic would say, given that you're a financial advisor, that this is not a completely objective view, that you can sort of point your finger at the terrible people and point your finger at yourself and say, I am amazing.
The thing that I would point out is, and you'll be aware, I'm sure, of Richard Thaler won the Nobel Prize a year and a half ago for his work on behavioral economics.
Yeah.
Almost a generation earlier, Jenny Kahneman won the Nobel with the work he did with Amos Tversky and shared it with his research partner Vernon Smith. There's a lot of research with regard to behavioral biases. So that's been recognized in the fairly recent past. Everyone, all of us, you, me, everyone, has biases. We all have them. The real question that it begs is, what are you doing to be militant about being self-aware about your biases, and what are you doing to take steps to make sure that you're not unwittingly giving biased advice if you're an advice giver? So, yeah, I my name's John DeGuy. I'm a financial advisor. I'm a portfolio manager. And like everyone else, I have my biases. I don't purport to not have them. But at least I am decent enough to acknowledge that they exist and to be self-aware of them, and then to try to take steps to mitigate them.
Well, it sounded like the introduction to a 12-step program there, but yeah. In your book, you have a 3-step program. Tell us about the 3 steps, or I don't know, 3 factors or issues that you believe investors should be focused on to, in your words, call out their advisor.
A lot of advisors are giving advice with good intentions that's inappropriate. And the only way that you can find out for sure whether or not your advisor is one of them is to follow the 3 steps. The first is to summon the courage to do like the ad campaign. You'll see the ad campaign from Questrade where people are, you know, I know Janet, I just can't afford to pay for both of us. So the first thing is you actually have to have the courage to march into your advisor's office and confront your advisor with regard to the quality and specificity of the advice that you're getting. The second thing that you have to do is you have to get the actual questions to ask, because you need to hold the advisor accountable. And so one of the things that the book does is it gives people specific questions to ask. I've got about 50 of them in the book. But then finally, thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, you need to be able to determine whether the answers you get are correct or not. And so there are details, again, in terms of the research. Don't take my word for it. Google is your friend. And I've set up a website, standup.today, where you can actually go to find the research papers that you can read yourself, or you can print them out and give to your advisor. So when your advisor says, well, something ridiculous like, you know, well, all that really matters, cost doesn't matter, what matters is return, you know, after costs. Well, actually, no, there's a lot of research that shows that cost does matter, and that performing funds can't reliably be chosen in advance, and the majority fail. So there's the evidence that shows it. So don't take my word for it because I've written a book or anything else. You can read articles from people that have won Nobel Prizes that show beyond any reasonable doubt that this is what's going on.
We don't have time to go through all 50, but if there were two or three of those questions that you believe Canadians should be asking their advisors, what would they be?
So I think one of the questions that you should ask advisor, I think the two things that you can ask about are past performance and cost. So the first question is, to what do you base your product recommendations on? And if the advisor said something like, well, this product has a 5-star rating or has its first quartile over 5 years or 10 years, that may be factually accurate, but that's not really indicative of what you might necessarily expect going forward. So chances are your advisor is misguided if he believes that that's true. Secondarily and similarly, what are you doing, Mr. Advisor, Ms. Advisor, to manage costs on my behalf? I understand that you have to get paid, and whatever your fee is what it is. Please tell me in writing. But beyond that, let's take that as a given. But what are you doing to manage the costs of the products that you recommend to me? And if there are other products that are available that might do the same sort of job, only cost me 0.5% or 1% a year less, why aren't you recommending them? So those are the sorts of questions that you can use to hold your advisor accountable.
What are your thoughts on robo-advisors? This is a category that's really come to prominence in the last couple of years. It wasn't around 10, 15 years ago. What's your take?
My take is that they play a good role. I think the market investors segment themselves fairly well, which is to say, if you think you can do it yourself, chances are you can. And if you can't, then chances are, if you think you can, chances are you can't. If you can't, then if you think that you can, so your situation is simple enough and you're comfortable with a robo, then you should consider using a robo. But if, and this usually comes down to a number of factors, sometimes it's complexity, sometimes it's just age and comfort with technology. But if you think that you want to deal with a human, then chances are you should deal with a human. So I think robos have a place. I applaud them. I think they're doing something useful. But they're not for everyone. And I'm not trying to suggest that human advisors are for everyone either. I think you have to be careful and know yourself.
Two of the areas in which advisors do serve a real purpose, we're going to park cost and investing strategy to the side for a second, is first, saving people from themselves. And second, the great ones really do have an ability to think holistically about a financial plan versus an investing plan. Where does that factor into your view about the advisor population writ large?
I would say that it's all over the map. There are really, really good advisors out there. There are some excellent advisors that I'm proud to be associated with and that I sort of blush because I don't think I can do as good a job as some of them. But my experience is that there are many that are rather less than good. And I'm trying to be politically correct in the way I sort of frame this. And it really is case by case. And so the point that I'm making and what the book does is it allows you to sort of use the book as a case study to test the advisor that you, the investor, are working with to see where your advisor fits on the spectrum with regard to both those things, which is the first is what I'm going to call constructive behavior modification, changing the way you behave and act and react. And then the second is the holistic integrated planning, which is different from person to person because different people have different circumstances. Some people have companies and set up trusts and do a lot of complex things, and many others just say, no, invest my RSP, invest my TFSA, we're done.
If I had the voice of some in the industry or even some advisors out there on my shoulder here, what they would probably say is that Canadians are better off to have an average investor than an average advisor than no advisor at all. What would you say to that notion?
I would agree to that notion, but I would respectfully say that that might be the wrong way of looking at it. There are some advisors that are so bad that they actually subtract value. And so an average advisor is frequently better than no advisor, and I tend to agree that that's probably true. But define average. If average is 50th percentile, then that might mean that as much as half the advisors are not worth what you're getting. So I think there are a lot of really, really excellent advisors out there. All I'm saying is there are also a lot of mediocre advisors out there, too. And you need to be careful to see which kind of advisor you are working with.
And find someone great.
Lots of great ones out there.
Yeah. John, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
John DeGuy is the author of a new book called Stand Up to the Financial Services Industry, Protecting Yourself from Well-Intended but Oblivious Advisors. His phrase, not mine. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, health entrepreneur Jennifer Buchanan is here to tell us about her new book, Wellness Incorporated, The Health Entrepreneur's Handbook. And later, a crash course in investing. The creative director of Wealth Simple, the robo-advisor, Mike Giebert, is going to be here. They have done a bunch of things in the content area, which I have deep ambivalence about. If you've missed an episode of Moolala, subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to podcasts on. And while you're there, give us a review. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are so many books out there that give advice on how to start your own business, become an entrepreneur. But one of the questions is, how do you build a sustainable business? And one in particular where it really is about doing good for others and for the world. A lot of people operate businesses in the health and wellness sector, and there are nuances to running businesses in that sector. Jennifer Buchanan offers a couple of ideas for health entrepreneurs. She's got a new book out called Wellness Incorporated, The Health Entrepreneur's Handbook. Hello, Jennifer.
Good afternoon.
How would you define what a health entrepreneur is? It doesn't just mean that they're healthy themselves. It means that they focus on a particular subsegment of the market.
Yeah, you know, this was an interesting concept for me because it all came out of the fact that I graduated into a profession that was going to be dealing with people within the healthcare sector. And it was, in my case, it was not about going to work in a hospital, but becoming community-based, where we were going to be a mobile service. And I had to start a business. And so it was brand new. And with starting a business, I had to learn a whole new set of guidelines of what does this mean when we're in a sector like us.
Yeah. The disclosure here is that, Jennifer, you and I are friends and have known each other for a long time, and I've been a big cheerleader of yours and your business. Tell our listeners about music therapy and how you, we talk about for hours, but the brief version of your journey to becoming a health entrepreneur yourself.
Well, what happened is that I had a remarkable experience as a young person with my granddad who'd suffered a stroke. And I went to his bedside. I was asked by my grandmother to sing his favorite song. I had no relationship really with my granddad to date. And he was a grumpy old guy, you know, who always found us kids underfoot. And he came alive when all of a sudden I sang this song. And it was simple. it was then that my granny introduced me to this profession of music therapy, and that using specific techniques, going into an array of population groups. So currently my company of 21 music therapists is serving palliative care and neuro. We are working with young kids. Our youngest actually is 2 months old. Our oldest is over 100. The scope of practice is massive. But again, in order to reach them, we had to establish this thing we call in the healthcare world a private practice. And one of the things they do not teach you as you're gaining all these technical skills to learn how to do all these amazing things with people to help them reach their goals is you're not getting a lot of business ed at the same time. And the business world in healthcare must be different than the other ways. And so I had to go on a quest. And that's kind of where you came into play for me, because after 20 years of really working hard to make this happen, I knew that I needed to collect some experts. And I needed to get a sense from them whether this company is truly viable and will be something that can sustain long into the future. That coupled with going back again after 20 years to get my MBA so I could start filling in some of these gaps, I've learned a lot. And I've learned that you can have a values-driven business that is focused on the welfare of humans, and that in itself is going to help help this world be better, and we can do business in a new way.
How do you help health entrepreneurs think about profit? Because I mean, if you watch news footage of the work that you do, I mean, it just brings people to tears because it's such a meaningful difference that you make, and it's so visceral and visual and real. But a pure business person would say, yeah, how do we turn that into an online program? And then we could, you know, there. And I am intentionally creating a very broad spectrum of the, you know, the head versus the heart definition of profit. But how do you reconcile the two with the entrepreneurs that you want to read your book and be inspired to be their best?
Well, you know, for us, the biggest lesson I had to learn is to be in it for the long game. That this isn't that quick around turn profit that often people are talking about. It isn't that. This is going to be something that you're in for a time. The margins are certainly going to be slimmer, and it's going to slowly grow over time. You need to be comfortable with that, but I believe that when you've got a mission that is you're incredibly passionate about, it's challenging, but incredibly doable. And so I like to encourage people to focus on the top line, focus on creating a business that's going to serve people well, and that bottom line can't help but follow.
Entrepreneurs tend to be driven people. How do you run a successful health and wellness business without compromising your own health and wellness?
Okay, that one I'm trying to get better. Because I don't even want to pretend that I'm an expert at this part yet, although it is a chapter in my book, but it's more a chapter in my book as I too am constantly struggling with it. It isn't easy. And, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot right now as we're recording this. We're in Mental Health Week. And it's been a really interesting time because we certainly work with a lot of people, from people that are in the corporate sector who can feel extremely stressed and maybe having that might have some implications for them at home and at work. But then we're also working in hospitals where people have just gone through one of the most difficult challenges of their life, and they're in recovery and their mood is low. And so we're in that all the time and reminded, as you're saying, that we also have to look after our own. Otherwise, we cannot provide the level of service required. And so for everyone, it is going to be a bit different. You know, for some people, it is about maybe dropping a few things. But for others, it's going to be things like adding in good things. It might be going to that gym more. It might be calling a friend on a regular basis, not just once in a while, but something that's going to give you a boost on a more consistent basis so you can stay strong through it all.
Your book goes through 9 strategies to help other health entrepreneurs strengthen their business. If you were to choose one or two that stand out as either being the most, I don't know, contrarian or original, or the most critical, what would they be?
The first one's going to be bliss point. Actually, I think that's where everything comes together. Where I start talking about the concept around bliss point came from the nutrition industry, which is this beautiful dose of the fat and the sugar and all the things that make deliciousness, right?
Yeah.
And it's the bridging of all that together. And I believe there's a bliss point in every person's business. And once you find that business, that's when you achieve that level of flow and ease that ultimately entrepreneurs are looking for, especially those in the early stages. I can remember it was just their words that would hit me at times were like, oh my gosh, this is such drudgery. Mm. You know? And you're so deeply entrenched in solving all the problems. But by finding this bliss point, which I call the intersection between heart, health, and mastery. And we've been speaking about health. Mastery would be your expertise and not only being a magnificent technician, but really understanding how to develop your own company's culture and getting strong at that and strengthening your strengths is going to improve your mastery. And then, of course, your heart is this mission that we have. All of us entrepreneurs have. We're, like you said, we're completely driven and we're so excited about what we're doing. When those things can align, and I do believe we can reach this bliss point, and we'll have more money, or more money, that too.
Yeah, that too.
But we will also have more ease in just moving through the day-to-day operations. And
at least you get to bring your guitar, too.
I do.
You do. Jennifer, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I really appreciate you coming to talk about your book.
Thank you.
Jennifer Buchanan is the author of Wellness Incorporated, The Health Entrepreneur's Handbook. Stay with us. Coming up next, Canada's cashless future. Equitable Bank's President and CEO Andrew Moore is here with some of the benefits of going cashless, and I'll probably provide him with some of the drawbacks that I see. And Jennifer Buchanan will be back for How I Do It. We'll ask how she manages her own money. To listen to past episodes of the program, you can go to our website, moolala.ca, or head on over to your podcast platform and download the full past podcast, write a review, subscribe to the next episode so it'll arrive right onto your device. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Digital banking is on the rise, with more and more Canadians tapping their credit cards and their debit cards and now even their phones to pay for goods and services. Cash is becoming less of a necessity. According to Payments Canada, cash use in Canada has declined by something like 30% since 2008. But are Canadians ready for a cashless future? There are certainly pros and cons to that question. Equitable Bank's President and CEO Andrew Moore is here to talk about why he believes it is time to go cashless. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
Why do you think now is the time to invest in a cashless future?
Well, I think technology has changed to the point that it's realistic. And it really feels to me there's huge advantages of being cashless. Particularly when I look at small businesses, for example, it's much easier not to have to deal with the cash in the till, the potential criminal risks that can be around that in the sense that people can steal the money. But also, just because from an efficiency perspective, tap a card, the money is immediately in a bank account where it can be used to pay suppliers, pay staff, People can work on looking after their customers rather than spending time kind of checking and reconciling the cash. So it all makes sense to me from an efficiency perspective.
Has there been a competitive dynamic that has pushed the cost down for small business, or are they still paying a reasonable fee to the card companies?
Well, I think they're paying too much, frankly, and I think that's something we need to address in Canada. The interchange fee on a credit card still seems too high to me to smaller, particularly to smaller merchants. I don't think I care as much about that when I'm dealing with big companies. But certainly when I pay my dry cleaners and I go to the local bookstore and I buy my coffee, I try to use my debit card, where the fees are much lower than they would be if I was just tapping a credit card.
There is an argument to be made that cash introduces friction into transactions, which can be a drag on the economy. Do you think that's a big issue? Is that something we should be thinking about and talking about?
I think it absolutely is. You know, when you think about it, it's almost like a medieval society, in the sense we're actually handing around tokens of value and putting them in our wallet and moving them around. And clearly there's costs around reprinting banknotes and all of those kinds of things, as opposed to in an electronic society, we could just have that digital record being stored. It's certainly much cheaper to do that.
There are a number of downsides on the cashless front. For me, as someone who focuses exclusively on personal finance and has real concerns about how people manage their cash flow on a weekly, monthly or yearly basis, one of the research points that is particularly compelling to me is the notion that paying with cash introduces the pain of spending, and credit cards anesthetize the pain of spending. And there's lots of research about the magnitude of that, something like 20%. People spend 20% more when they're using a card instead of cash. What role do you think financial institutions like yours have to play in helping Canadians manage their cash flow so that they don't overspend?
I think what you're raising is a real issue, and we actually have to sort of change culturally so that cash, when we use a credit card, it feels the same as pulling cash out of your wallet. But I think that's just an evolution in society. We've learned to deal with lots of technology over the years, and have learned to deal with it responsibly. So there is a learning. I'm not an unabashed supporter of just immediately going cashless. Let's recognize that that's a challenge and that needs education. And I think things like our banking apps can help that in terms of tracking total amounts you may have spent on certain things over the last few weeks, and sort of keep a record of that to try and nudge you and say maybe you're spending over your budget limits. So we do provide some of those tools. I don't think banks are always the best people, frankly, to give consumer education about personal finance. I think, you know, the role that you play in personal finance educators are at least as important as the banks, and probably, you know, sitting in a much more less biased position to do that. But I think as banks, we can provide tools that help the consumer do that, and hopefully you can help support those banks provide useful tools.
The two other downsides: one is research that shows people are more impulsive and buy more unhealthy things when they're paying with credit, and second, that they have a lower emotional attachment to what they bought, which is fascinating to me. And it's fascinating both because I can't believe it, but then at the very same moment I think, oh yeah, of course that makes sense. If you were to count out the 20s like I would have done or you would have done in our youth and pay for something that you had been saving for, you can see that it would have more value. How do we help consumers make that translation? Because I think you're right in declaring that our end state will be a cashless world. My 9-year-old manages cash because she has allowance and I pay her in cash. Right. But in 10 years, that's going to be ridiculous.
Well, I think you know, effectively we can replicate some of this stuff on the apps, right? So it's really, we're doing lots of things socially on our cell phones. So why can't we manage money the same way in terms of having things that show spending limits that we're looking for on certain types of spending things? As you say, if we're spending money on fripperies that we shouldn't be, maybe we can kind of capture that as part of the app solution. Certainly within EQ Bank, we're able to divide into sub-accounts, and then you could, you know, arguably sort of put $50 aside every month if that's what you plan to spend on coffee. And when it gets down to zero, that you know you've reached your caffeine limit for the month. So that's deliberately why that application is available for you. You could call it your coffee account and automatically have the money going in there every month. So I would say, though, it's a bit of a DIY exercise at this point. And I think sometimes as bankers, we make it a little hard for consumers to things that really resonate with the way you want to think about your life, right?
Why do you even have a business? And I ask this with all seriousness, in that the big banks have all the money. They have the enormous brand power that goes with their marketing spend and the tens of thousands of employees that they have. How has EQ been able to carve out a meaningful niche given the massive competitive dynamics you're up against?
Well, you know, yes, they're very powerful banks, but we have a unique position. So we position ourselves as Canada's challenger bank. We pay a very high rate of interest just on cash sitting in the account. And to your point, you know, one of the great advantages is you get 2.3% on your money until you actually buy that cup of coffee. So you're actually getting, admittedly, it's only pennies a day, but it all adds up. And so by having an unabashed different approach than the big banks, then we can have a lower cost structure. For example, we'll never send you a bank statement. All the big banks would offer you that choice. Mm. That takes cost out of running our bank, and we can actually be profitable and hopefully offer a value to the consumer that's not being offered by everybody else.
Younger people, not even millennials, but the generation that followed them, they've grown up in a world in which their life is largely digital. How do you think about the demographic that is over the age of 50, 60, 70? Are they your customers? Do you want them to be your customers?
Certainly they can be. I think it's a question of attitude. There are lots of 60, 70-year-olds that love technology and are happy to engage on that basis. But if you really need the comfort of walking into a bank branch, we're not the one for you, frankly, if you want to go and have a chat with somebody in a bank branch. If you want to pick up the phone and talk to our call center, we have great people that can help you there. But we're never going to send you a statement. You're never going to have a checkbook with EQ Bank. But if you want to interact digitally, and that's how you think about life, there's no reason why somebody in their 70s can't do that as well as somebody in their 15s.
How do you think about, this is a two-part, how do you think about security and how do you think about privacy in the context of a cashless society? In some ways, I'm sure there are big advantages because you don't have to worry about your wallet getting stolen because you just cancel your card in 5 seconds, but there's some disadvantages too.
Oh, I think on the security side, there's things we need to do. And I recognize you did a podcast recently on open banking. And So there are things we need to do with more secure APIs to button down the security. Although I would say even today, it's already better than it was in the old days of carrying cash around. There's less cash being lost. We're immediately able to disable a bank account if there's been some compromise. And we can recognize through patterns of behavior that it's likely being compromised. So I think that's already moving in the right direction. You know, there's very few bank robberies anymore, frankly, because there's
right.
no money in the money sitting in the bank.
Right.
So I think that's something that is, although one might, when there are fraudulent takeovers of accounts and so on, it's bad news. In reality, overall, the banking system's becoming more secure. I think on the privacy side as well, we need to be very careful about these things. But we do have biometric identification on the cell phones. It is actually pretty hard to crack into the banking systems. And I think there's broader conversation, obviously, with people like Facebook and Google and how much they're doing to protect our information. Mm. Frankly, there's much broader leaks of information there. And hopefully we'll all kind of converge where we can choose the levels of privacy that we require. And many of us may choose to be extremely private. Others may be more comfortable with data being shared.
Andrew, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it. And I call on you to stand up for the cash flow questions I have raised here. Andrew Moore, the president and CEO of Equitable Bank. Stay with us. Coming up next, new to the world of investing, Wealthsimple's creative director, Mike Giebert, will be here to tell us about their new Investing Masterclass. Interesting content. I'm not sure how I feel about it, though, and I'll tell you why. And How I Do It, we'll ask Jennifer Buchanan about how she manages her money. What feedback do you have on the show so far today? Shoot us an email. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Traditional media has been delivering personal finance content for generations. Now, more recently, financial institutions have started producing their own content. Sometimes it feels like it's self-serving or less credible than Money Sense, The Globe and Mail, or even Moolah La, this show. The content coming out of Wealthsimple is different, which is really annoying to me. The robo-advisor just published an excellent tabloid publication, has just released his masterclass on investing, which is a series of 10 short videos. The first one's about the stock market. So we're going to talk to Wealthsimple's creative director, Mike Giebert. He joins us now to talk about the company's approach to content. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
I genuinely am annoyed. I'm not kidding. I mean, I as a journalist, we see mostly crappy content, and so we can sit back and be really smug about it and look at them. They're just trying to sell a product. When I flipped open your magazine, it talks about the reasons why you decided to do this. You believe it'll make a difference in the world, blah, 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 but also that you thought it would be fun. Tell us at the highest level how you view your role in developing and producing content at Wealthsimple.
Good question. So I think early on, we started to experiment with lots of different forms of communication. But one of the things that we always came back to was this idea that money is a very emotional experience. So money can relate to your childhood, the way that you were brought up. Money can be something that you have a lot of fear over, a lot of grief over. And what we sort of found early on was the more that we tell very open, honest stories about money, the more that we can be overly revealing about people's money and people's experiences with money. Not only is that like a really ripe territory to talk about our brand, it's a really ripe territory to just find new stories to tell. So it ends up being fun. It's a lot of fun to find new ways to talk about money.
Are you an ad guy by background?
Yeah, that's
okay.
My background.
So many people who are in the world of content today come from journalism.
Yeah.
What are the pros and cons of coming from an ad background?
I think part of it is, you know, my background was telling big emotional stories, finding interesting ways to have people connect with a brand. Sometimes that is making funny content. Sometimes that's making content that's going to pull at the heartstrings. Sometimes that's stuff that's going to shock you. You also learn this skill of connecting with somebody quickly. If you're trying to convey a message in 30 seconds or 60 seconds in an ad, you've got to sort of grab them quickly. But you know, I think one thing that I always learned in the ad world before coming to this is you're much more successful connecting with somebody on an emotional level than trying to connect with them on a practical level.
I started in traditional packaged goods. I worked on Pampers diapers for many years. And back in the day, you'd try to sneak your brand benefit in and all that. If you do that to the nth degree, the consumer totally turns out they're on to you. How do you find the happy medium in the work that you do?
I mean, this is going to sound a little loftier than it's meant to, but we always try to find the brand truth. You know, so is there something absolutely true about the product that you're selling that will connect with somebody on a human emotional level? So with Wealthsimple, yes, we can lower your fees. We can make it super tax efficient. We can do all of these things to make your investing platform work really smoothly. But that's not really a way that you can connect with people. So if you can actually first initiate a conversation that's about something that's human that they can connect to. Mm. So whether it's something about their relationship with money from their past, or telling interesting stories like a nun who's taken a vow of poverty, or you know, an athlete who started out completely broke and now has millions and lost it all. If you can find sort of an emotional human story to bring them into the world of money, it kind of gets them to talk about it and open up much more.
This masterclass idea, I mean, we've seen them, the brand masterclass advertised on Facebook with Steve Martin and Gordon Ramsay. What were you trying to achieve with the investing masterclass specifically, in addition to ripping off that idea that we've seen? That costs money. Those programs cost money.
You know, I think on some level we're trying to poke a little bit of fun at those. I love those. I consumed a lot of those. I love the Steve Martin one, for example, or my favorite one was the Jane Goodall one.
Oh, yeah.
She has a really great one. But I think we saw that there's so much online investing or personal finance videos specifically on YouTube that don't have a ton of production value, you know, don't have a lot of them aren't very funny. A lot of them are very straightforward. So through our magazine, we've written hundreds of stories about personal finance. We've written a ton about investing. What if we could take all of those stories, bring them together, and try to sort of, you know, give you your medicine with a spoonful of sugar and make it funny and entertaining and something that you actually want to watch? I've coming from advertising, I've never made a piece of content that was 45 minutes long. Most of my content was 30 seconds long.
Right.
So to make something that is this long was a real challenge, especially, you know, we run this through compliance and you know, investing experts have to review all of this content to make sure it's accurate. And then to take that and actually, you know, try to get work with an actor or comedian and try to make it funny.
Nicholas Braun is who you chose, yep. American actor, not a nobody, but not Jim Parsons. What were you going for with him?
He's somebody that we love on the show Succession. So we've been fans of him. We always sort of talk about that show. It's interesting because there is this sort of, you know, it's financial. So we talk a little bit about it in the office. We always really liked him. And we were trying to find somebody that could sort of come across as an expert, but also not in a very serious way.
Right.
So something about him, I mean, he's really disarming, and he's, I guess maybe part of it is that he has the look of an expert. You kind of believe that he's this financial expert. When he starts talking, you know that he's not taking it too seriously.
Right.
So we just loved him. He came up as an option, and yeah, was the perfect guy.
Well, Simple has operations in Canada, the US, and the UK.
Yeah.
How do you manage content across multiple geographies? What translates, what does not?
It's a really good question. So, some of the stuff that I was talking about earlier, just these fundamental human truths as they relate to money, are very universal. So a lot of stories do really connect from one country to another. When it comes down to specifics about currency or rules around specific financial products, or even the difference between a TFSA and a 401k and an IRA, like. That's when you really have to be careful and make sure that you're doing multiple versions of each story. For this course, for example, we decided to make it majority for Canada, our largest audience, and then a close second was the U.S.
Why should consumers trust you? Why should they trust Wealthsimple? And I say that because as a journalist, I have nothing to sell. Listen to my show, buy my book, and that's it. But you have something big to sell, and the ambition for Wealthsimple is quite dramatic. It's not just Canada. It has a much broader mandate. You've had good luck bringing in assets, but market share wise, you're still not a huge player. Yeah. Why should people trust you?
I think the core of what we do, the core of our main investing product is really simple, time-tested, old-school way of investing. You know, buy and hold, don't pay a lot of money for your ETFs, rebalance regularly. The product that we sell is fundamentally good for people. And I think we've done so much research and in trying to connect with people, we've run so many stories that sort of reinforce that worldview. And luckily it's this thing that the deeper that you go and the more research that you do, the more that you see that not just us, but lots of other financial professionals say that this is a great way to invest. So we feel pretty good about it.
You're not trying to put journalism out of business,
no,
are you?
No, we're not.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate
Mike Giepert is the creative director of Wealthsimple. It is a robo-advisor, and they've been doing a lot of content, most recently a master class, but also a magazine. Who prints a magazine? That's a terrible idea, magazine. Magazines are over. They're done. One of the ways that I think we can improve how people behave when it comes to our money is to talk about it. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And so that's why we've launched this new segment called How I Do It, in which every show I talk to one of our guests about how they actually manage their personal finances. And some people do this for a living. Other people don't do this for a living. But I ask them kind of the same questions. None of these questions are ones that I would not answer myself on this show or in a public forum. Our guest today, Jennifer Buchanan, author of Wellness Incorporated, The Health Entrepreneur's Handbook. Jennifer, are you ready?
I'm ready.
You're ready. You're horrified, but you're ready.
I am.
Here's a softball. You buy coffee at a coffee shop. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit? And why?
Bruce, I use my rewards card. I put money off of my credit card onto my rewards card. And that's because I'm often meeting people in coffee shops. And so it's a bit of a write-off for me, but I also collect all the points because I like the free coffee. But I also know, before you even tell me, that they are taking all my information and using that. I am well aware of all that's happening.
But you're so interesting. Your information is so interesting. The world should benefit from that.
That's right.
What about your financial life is automated? Have you set up things like, retirement savings or vacation savings or bill payment, or do you do all that manually?
Oh, gosh. Okay, yes. what's interesting? So this is actually very interesting. Because of running my own business, everything about my business is automated, and everything else I give over to my husband, James.
Should I dial him into this conversation?
Yes. So he literally, I am trusting him 100% of the time on my personal stuff. Luckily, he's a good guy.
Yeah, or so you think. I mean, who knows? Maybe you'll look at them differently having a conversation with me. What is one thing, aside from logistics with James, that sounds like it's working well, but what is an argument that you two have over money? Or are you just perfect and I'm going to throw up a bit in my mouth?
Oh, gosh, no. I wouldn't say we're perfect.
What do you talk about? What do you talk about when it comes to money that's like, James?
You know, yeah, no, it's the little things. I am the person who wants to do like upgrades around the house, and I feel I have to bring on my best negotiation tactics. And so because he's definitely someone who would rather save, you know, and we're both Scottish, but somehow I didn't get the Scottish part.
Right. So what are your strategies? Do you, your music therapist, do you bring out your guitar and sing about the new deck to him?
Yeah, no, I don't know if that would work either for him. He can be tough. But, you know, what I feel does work for us is when we do a plan, you know, we look at the year and we go, okay, let's pick one or two things that we really do want to purchase this year. And I always make sure one of those is a vacation.
Right. Now, in the early days for any entrepreneur, there is a meshing of personal and professional, and what's the business, what's the personal, how do I take money out of the business? What would you say have been the hard-earned lessons of shifting to Jennifer runs a business versus Jennifer is a business?
Yeah, that you're right. That was the big change. The indicator was when I started paying myself regularly, and that it actually, that's automated. I pay myself an automated amount twice a month, just like all my staff. That was the big shift, but it took about 10 years to get there. And until that happened, even though I had been paying myself a little bit along the way, but occasionally you couldn't pay yourself one time or six times because you had other things to look after. Until I made that shift, I didn't feel like I was really in business for sure. Yeah.
What has been your best financial move in your life, and what has been your worst?
You know, okay, the best financial moment that happened was that we got a gift. This sounds so bad. Both my husband and I have been entrepreneurs. Early in the game, when our kids were really little, times were really tough for us and very... very small steps were being made financially for us to move ahead into our dream of owning a home. And you know what? It was James's parents who gave us a one-time gift of that got us into the market. And I will forever, ever be grateful for that moment. It really did change the game for us. So I'm not against anyone else out there wanting to give me a gift. And the worst decision, oh God, there's so many.
Like, just choose one.
I make bad decisions all the time. You know, because I go out, I'm learning that it's saving money and buying quality really is important. I have bought a lot of things that, you know, because I've really wanted it, and then they break down, and then I have nothing. And I would say that that happened way too many times, especially in the early days. So just save up and spend money on something of quality.
Right. Well, maybe buying your book would be something of quality that people could do. Jennifer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Buchanan, author of Wellness Incorporated, The Health Entrepreneur's Handbook. And that was our How I Do It segment. That is our show for today. You can subscribe to the show on your podcast platform. Feel free to write us a little review or sing us a song. You can connect with me on social media. I am Facebook Bruce Ellery Mulala or @BruceElry on Twitter. Thanks very much for joining us, and have a great day. We'll